I'm gonna take House Bill 2062 and open a work session on House Bill 2062, and I'm going to ask Sandra Flicker to come up. Thank you. Judith, you want to remind us what 2062 is?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2062 is the measure that requires operators and passengers of Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicles to wear motorcycle helmets with a fastened chin strap. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to let you go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. And first, I want to thank the chair for giving us the opportunity to come during a work session and present an amendment to the bill to the committee. With me today is my manager of regulatory affairs, David Shaw, who's going to provide the actual testimony, and then Mr. Goddard, Don Goddard from the Oregon People's Utility District Association, wanted to just make some brief comments as well. So I will let Mr. Shaw take over.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sandy. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Shaw, and I'm representing Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association today. I'm here to ask for your support to the amendment to House Bill 2062 as attached, exempting utilities under Section 2, Sub 2A of the bill. Utility systems utilize various classes of all-terrain vehicles in their daily utility operations. These vehicles are typically utility class ATVs and typically include two seats and a utility bed for carrying work-related equipment. However, we also operate smaller class 1 ATVs in conjunction with other utility vehicles while conducting routine operations of maintenance and electrical systems. The general rationale for this exemption: first, electric utility vehicles, including the ATVs, typically operate at low speeds. Electric utility personnel strictly adhere to numerous federal and state guidelines, including the National Electric Safety Code, federal and state OSHA regulations, and their own internal safety programs. The requirement of a motorcycle helmet for utility personnel will interfere with two-way radio communications and verbal instructions utilized by linemen conducting their maintenance operations. Electric cooperative personnel involved in utility operations wear protective headgear throughout the workday. These helmets meet or exceed NESC and OSHA requirements while still allowing the workers to utilize communications equipment, as well as receive and hear verbal instructions from coworkers. This requirement creates an unnecessary burden and expense for utilities to purchase, issue, and maintain numerous helmets for all personnel who have the potential to operate the equipment. Electric cooperatives take safety concerns very seriously and work hard to keep annual reportable injuries to a minimum. Linemen and utility personnel receive numerous hours of classroom and hands-on instruction related to safety principles, practices, and procedures. ORECA requests your support in this matter, and we're available to answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Don Goddard, represent six Oregon People's Utility Districts, and don't want to repeat what's already been said, but the PUDs have similar concerns and a similar situation as the cooperatives. Just as an example, sometimes our communication systems to operate the utilities are on mountains that don't otherwise have normal road access, and so our folks would be using ATVs to get up to those job sites, as an example. And we think the local work rules and national safety codes are the place to deal with these kind of issues. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Committee, do I have Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Shaw, so you mentioned the protective headgear. Can you describe that for us?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the headgear, the lineman's helmet that we typically, that is used in most cooperatives, utilities that I would, that I could think of, are a standardized type of helmet that gives them protection from any kind of falling objects. It also provides electrical properties, if you will, while they're working on energized lines. Most of the helmets that you'll see used are going to exceed any NESC or OSHA standard for protection of the head.
Yeah, follow up.
So if that meets those standards, then why would you be opposed to the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, there's several reasons, as we've noted earlier. The largest one is safety. When you apply the motorcycle helmet in the operation of a lineman's job and his task, it's going to interfere with his communications gear that he may be using. Some people have little headsets that go on their ears so that they can communicate at 100 yards, 200 yards. They also use voice and visual signals to communicate back and forth to know when to stop or to do some task in the lineman business. So we think it's a safety issue. Just to have that helmet on causes other associated safety factors, we think.
Then I'm confused because I thought I heard you saying that they already wear protective headgear.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the headgear doesn't cover up the ears like a motorcycle helmet would. They come down to right about here, and they have a brim around them, if you will. The ears are open.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it's a completely different helmet. It's not a motorcycle helmet that they wear. It's a lineman's helmet that they wear. So this particular piece of legislation requires a motorcycle helmet. So that's our issue, is we wear a helmet, but it happens to be a different kind of helmet that is associated with the work that we do, and it's not a motorcycle helmet.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to mention that I didn't hear that they were in opposition to the bill. It was just to exempt the utility workers because they have other required headgear under other between OSHA and the electrical code workers, the safety code, National Electric Safety Code, that there are other. I'm going to guess, and I guess I can ask both David and Don to confirm this, that your folks aren't out on a regular basis doing high-flying, breaking air and those kinds of things on these ATVs. I'm assuming that when they're carrying gear and so forth, that they're out there actually moving up and down the utility easements and rights-of-way and certainly other public right-of-ways as they're coming and going.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that's right. They're not out there for recreational purposes. They're out there in a hazardous situation anyway because of the nature of their work. And I think IBEW workers are some of the most safety-conscious folks around.
Madam Chair, if I may, do we anticipate that there is a set of amendments to incorporate the fact that the utility workers presently are covered under other and use separate headgear, which facilitates their ability to communicate using the existing communication devices, which would not necessarily be compatible to actual ATV headgear?
Representative Butler, we do have a proposed amendment. I don't know that it goes quite that far in describing what they already have to do. I think
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as far as I understand it, if you look on House Bill 2062, line 26,
page.
Correct. And the testimony that we've gotten has one attached that's been kind of hand engrossed.
Right. Adding utilities to the exceptions there listed.
Oh, it's on his testimony. Okay, I just need to find the attachment. I beg your pardon. Thank you. Will there be, Madam Chair, will there be an actual amendment? Because I think that we had talked about the possibility of other amendments as well.
Yes. Okay. There'll be an amendment that we won't work the bill today.
Okay.
So we'll get a chance and make sure we have everything we need. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gentlemen, just very quickly, do either of your organizations have a history of injuries related to ATV use?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, Of the several co-ops I spoke with, I asked that same question. Have you had any incidents where you had any head injuries when operating these Class 1 ATVs? And I got an emphatic no. No reportable injuries.
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I just can't answer that question. It's none that I'm aware of, but that's out of ignorance rather than anything else.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for coming up.
Thank you again, Madam Chair and Committee.
And before I close the work session, is there anyone else that would like to come up and address us? Since it's your bill, maybe you'd like to come up and...
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron. I'm the legislative coordinator with the State Parks Department. We are not opposed to an amendment that would include utilities as one of the excluded groups in Section 2, Sub 2. That would be the appropriate place to put it. Thank you.
Representative
Madam Chair, while we have Jim Myron here, I just wanted to confirm two questions that I had. Number one, with regard to animals, this does not, I don't know that the bill refers to persons. I guess it does say the person. So animals aren't going to have to be protected under this. If I'm working my cattle and I've got my dog on board.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I don't believe that animals need to have a helmet under this bill.
Yeah, I just want that on the record. There's lots of foolishness that goes on sometimes with these kinds of things. The second item I did have was with regard to the trailering up. That seemed to be a problem. You'd sent me a note, and you said in your note, quote, I would be very surprised if law enforcement officers would cite ATV operators for not having a helmet in this situation, that is, with regard to loading and unloading. So are you recommending selective law enforcement with regard to the helmet?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that it came up during the last hearing on this bill that basically the law enforcement agencies use some selectivity now. If that is not sufficient, you could always do an additional amendment that would exclude loading and unloading from a truck or a trailer.
Madam Chair, I think that would really be appropriate. I don't want selective law enforcement. I want the police in the state of Oregon to have a black and white law that says, wait a minute, this isn't going to happen. That person needs to have a helmet on under these circumstances. And while there are some of these, it's my understanding that they can be roaded off just by putting them in neutral and pushing them, and that's part of the process. They really wouldn't be riding them. They wouldn't even be necessarily ignited under most circumstances for that purpose, but certainly the reloading of them, they may have their helmets already packed. So that is of concern to me, Madam Chair, that we at least address that so that we don't have to have this issue of selective law enforcement. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. I would maybe suggest that you see about having an amendment drafted to do that. I'm not sure I feel real strongly one way or another, and you're going to get my opinion here, is that I still wonder if a person is actually riding or on one and loading it up, if it's in the back of a pickup, if that could be kind of a dangerous, as dangerous as riding it somewhere else. So that would be my concern. But seeing no other comments, we'll go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2062 and wait for amendments in that long line of people out there that are waiting for amendments. Okay, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2072. And Judith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2072 repeals the sunset on changes regarding reciprocity for ocean charter vessel licenses as well as outfitting and guiding licenses of other states. You do have a hand-engrossed version with the -1 amendments. Those amendments allow the State Marine Board to adopt rules to waive the annual fees for a person who possesses a current Oregon outfitter and guide registration and operates in the waters of the Columbia River downstream from the Lewis and Clark Bridge. That amendment also adds an emergency clause that would be effective upon passage. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact on both the original measure and the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, committee, is everybody familiar with this? Do I need to bring someone forward to...
Madam Chair, this was the hand-engrossed version that we received in our very first hearing on the, let's see, was it 31st of January in our very first hearing. And we were handed a four-page, I think, engrossed copy to encompass those issues. The testimony by Paul Don Hefner and Jack Glass, Paul Rainey, and the folks that came forward at that time was that with the Dash 1, I think that we were probably ready to go ahead and work this bill.
Right.
We are in a work session, Madam Chair.
Yes, we are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I would then make a motion that the Dash 1 amendment dated January 26th, 07, be appended and made a part of House Bill 2072. That would be printed, I'll end my motion at that point.
There's been a motion to add the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2072.
Actually, I have a quick question here.
Okay.
I have two things, Madam Chair, in my file. One that's hand engrossed, dated the 26th, and then I saw another one, I think that was dated the 25th, proposed amendments. Are they the same?
Madam Chair, Representative Reed, the only set of amendments that I have are the January 25th version. Those are the Dash 1 amendments that I have.
So the copy of the 26th have the Dash 1 amendments incorporated in them?
Hand engrossed.
Correct, and they were hand engrossed on the 26th
that's
of January.
Fine.
So that's the same exact amendment.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing none, then the Dash 1 amendments
are adopted.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move that House Bill 2072 with the Dash 1 amended be reprinted as engrossed and sent to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Butler moves House Bill 2072 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, and those of the opinion House Bill 2072 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. That does not roll off my tongue. As amended recommendation, we'll vote aye. Those opposed, no, and the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Butler?
Aye.
Representative Butler?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Chair
Bottas?
Aye. House Bill 2072, as amended, having received the required. She moved my script. As required. Vote, and will be sent to the floor. And is there anyone who wants to carry this, or do we think it should go to consent?
It could go to the consent calendar.
Okay. It has been moved by Representative Tomei that it will be on the consent calendar.
Objection.
Without objection. Okay. And close the work session on House Bill 2072. I guess I'm not doing this enough. It's just not getting. And we have one here. Okay. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2064. Okay.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2064 directs the Department of Transportation to issue titles to owners of Class 1 and Class 3 all-terrain vehicles purchased after January 1st, 2008. It creates an offense of failure to title the vehicle, punishable with a fine of up to $90. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and call up Tim Wood and Kaiken Stone.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Tim Wood, the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and we're here this afternoon to ask for your support with House Bill 2064. As the committee administrator has pointed out, this bill would require the titling of all ATV Class 1, Class 3 ATV vehicles in the state of Oregon that are used on public land for public recreation purposes. And Kylene Stone, who's the assistant director of the department, will provide some further information.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kylene Stone, Assistant Director, Recreation Programs and Planning, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. Today, I'm here representing the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, seeking your support on House Bill 2064. Except for certain exempted classifications, this bill will require dirt bikes and all-terrain vehicles purchased after the date of January 1st, 2008, to be titled through the Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles. The intention of this bill is to result in better information available to law enforcement agencies to help determine actual ownership of ATVs and motorcycles. In 2006, as you may recall from earlier testimony, our agency contracted with Oregon State University to look at best practices in the area of improving safety outcomes for people recreating on ATVs. And in the course of that research, especially in interviews with law enforcement personnel, OSU researchers came to learn that one other area of concern, especially for law enforcement, is the issue of unable to identify the actual owners of ATVs, particularly when it's obvious that an ATV has been stolen. It's very difficult to reunite the ATV with its owner because we don't have mandatory titling in this state. Many owners of dirt bikes and ATVs do secure titles for their vehicles. It's necessary for insurance purposes, but it is not a requirement under current law. As a result, it makes it a lot easier for people to fence stolen property in this state, primarily. According to the 2005 Specialty Vehicle Institute of America report, 31 states have mandatory titling, including the neighboring states of Washington, Idaho, and California. We have talked with many ATV constituents and others to determine support for this law and have generally heard support. The only concern that we have really heard is over the issue of having to pay the $55 titling fee, and that would be the responsibility of the individual who owns the vehicle. This bill would not apply to vehicles owned by the federal, state, or local government agencies and does not apply to ATVs used exclusively for farming, agriculture, forestry, nursery, or Christmas tree operation, or on land owned or leased by the owner of the vehicle. The Department of Motor Vehicles has expressed to us that they also support this legislation and has determined that there will be additional workload created by this bill, and it would require an additional staff from their agency. However, the cost to cover the salary for that staff would be covered by the additional fees collected. And we respectfully request your support on this bill and hope that it will help to reduce the number of stolen ATVs in Oregon and improve law enforcement's ability to identify owners of specific vehicles.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Buckley.
Just to be clear, the $55 fee is an estimate, and your suggestion is that Ways and Means should look at that to make sure that the fee covers the cost of the full-time employee but not go over the cost of full-time employee?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, currently the way the statute would be written, $55 is the fee that DMV charges for titling all vehicles, and the fee would be $55. The reason Ways and Means would need to evaluate it is to determine if the Department of Motor Vehicles needed additional limitation to spend that additional revenue.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does state parks collect information from ATV owners when they issue riding permits?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we collect a small amount of information, including their name, their address, and the vehicle identification number.
What was the last part again?
I'm sorry. The vehicle identification number.
Is that the serial number of the vehicle?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I believe it's. I'm not sure whether it's the same as the VIN number is the same as the serial number or not, but it, you know, it's like the vehicle identification number on a motor vehicle, a car, or whatever.
Okay. So I think there is a mechanism in place for collection of that. Follow up, if I may. Those permits are issued to who? The state park permits for ATV riders.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, those permits are issued to people who intend to ride their ATVs on public lands for ATV recreation, and essentially those permits are permission to use the facilities and the resources from those permits, which are $10 for a two-year permit. Those resources go into the ATV program for trail maintenance, additional trail development, law enforcement.
Follow up, if I may. House Bill 2064 exempts private property use and is focused on public land. Okay. Follow up.
Yes.
Don't we already have a mechanism in place to collect this information?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, currently the information that is collected from State Parks Department for the two-year permits, the $10 permits, is pretty rudimentary, and we do not have a mechanism or staffing capacity right now to evaluate things like change of address. We don't really keep up with the data on those once we make the sale of the permit. So a titling process is a little more it has more rigor to it and continues to – it's a much more – would stand up in court much better as far as identifying the owner of the vehicle in the event that it needed to be identified.
Would it perhaps make sense for us just to expand the existing program rather than to create two different licenses?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the issue right now is that the Department of Motor Vehicles actually does have process in place. They do titling for all the other vehicles in the state, and they actually do have the processes to and the administration to support that, whereas at state parks our administration is very rudimentary, and we would have to develop a program to make ours more robust and actually serve the need of identifying those vehicles and tying those to actual owners of the vehicles.
Just one last question.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. Does it concern the Oregon State Parks that we're going to put on a second tax onto these folks? We have a $10 one, and now we potentially could put another $55 fee onto folks who are doing no different recreational activity. Nothing's changed on their behalf. And now we're going to be asking them for additional dollars to collect the same information that's already being collected, just not reported in a manner that we need it reported?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think, you know, the ATV owners are ultimately the ones who benefit, you know, collectively as a group from having this information available to law enforcement, because it's law enforcement's ability to use the information, to track it, to be able to return stolen vehicles and protect their property.
One
whether that would affect every individual or not, I mean, it would affect those with whom vehicles have been stolen or whatever.
One last question.
Mm-hmm.
I assume the vast majority of folks who acquire ATVs finance them. And I would, with my assumption, I would also assume that insurance companies require insurance on these ATVs. Are they going to be here today to testify for the need for this identification system?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know if there's anyone here from the insurance industry or not. I don't know.
To me, just my last comment, then I'll let this go. To me, it would seem as if the people who have the most to gain from supporting this legislation would be the insurance companies, the people who are having to take the loss from the theft of these ATVs. And by the way, colleagues, I've had ATVs stolen from me. I've had them stolen. And I've also acquired ATVs or a motorcycle from a person who purchased one and no longer wanted it and sold it to me. But to me, it would seem like the people who stand to gain the most from this are the insurance companies who are going to be able to limit their losses. And I'm hoping today out in the audience we have a handful of insurance folks who are going to step forward and say, this is a problem in the state of Oregon, and the state of Oregon is going to step up and address that problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I'm not sure if there are any insurance representatives in the audience, but at this point, The vast majority of people in Oregon who do buy ATVs when they finance them are required by through the process of financing to have a title anyway. So the Department of Motor Vehicles is already engaged in this, and this really sort of covers more of the people who are, you know, buying over Craigslist and that kind of thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Billman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You charge $10 every 2 years? Is that the what you charge for your registration?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, that is correct, yes.
That's not correct. That's for a riding permit.
For a riding permit. I'm sorry, yes, not for registration.
It's not for registration. It's for a riding permit.
Exactly.
Okay. Have you investigated what it would cost to upgrade that system to be a registration system rather than just a riding system?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, we actually have talked about that, but we have also quickly come to the realization that the Department of Motor Vehicles already does that, and so it seemed, from our perspective, seems a bit duplicative, and so we haven't gone much further with the discussion.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kylene, you'd indicated that presently titles are being issued by the DMV. I can't imagine that the process of acquiring and the sale of ATVs over the last 20 years has not required some kind of paperwork to track ownership and those kinds of things, certainly amongst the private parties. Tell me who issues titles now and what the cost of that is and if that title is transferable.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, as I've testified, the Department of Motor Vehicles issues the titles now in the instances where, generally where there's financing involved. It's a voluntary titling program right now, and it costs $55 to get a title through the Department of Motor Vehicles. But there are people, instances that have been reported to us where there have been sort of theft rings from other states, particularly from Idaho, that have stolen ATVs from out of state and then brought them into Oregon and basically fenced them for very low prices that are very attractive to buyers, but there's no title follow-up or no requirement to have that in those cases.
Follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. So in the past, this has been done by bill of sale, I'm assuming, and the bill of sale is evidence, the purchase between a willing buyer and a willing seller, but that just isn't recorded anywhere. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that is my understanding, yes.
Okay. Well, so if I understand the correct nature of this bill, what we are presently doing voluntarily, as well as the tracking for those folks that have permits to run on public lands, what we're doing now is making mandatory that which folks have chosen to do voluntarily in the past when they have been concerned enough about the fear or concern of their insurance and the financing that they would lose their equipment. So we're now going to mandate, and it's my understanding that the nature of this bill is to mandate some greater degree of safety and force upon folks this greater degree of safety of ownership of the paper that is the underlying ownership document. Is that correct? Is that my understanding?
Well, editorialized a little bit, but yeah, that's
okay.
Correct. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make clear that for vehicles purchased after January 1st, 2008, is that new vehicles, if I buy one of Representative Smith's vehicles, would I have to register that one?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, it would be for all sales transactions after that date.
Not
new and used.
Yes. New and used, yes. Okay. And approximately how many sales do you think that might be in a year?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, the number of new vehicles sold in the state of Oregon over the last several years is in the range of 20 to 25,000 vehicles a year.
Thank you. Madam Chair, so if we multiply that times 55, and I don't want to do that.
Approximately $121,000 a year.
So I'm wondering why this bill would have to go to Ways and Means. Maybe that's something we should talk about in work session.
Maybe I can help. The Ways and Means process appropriates that money and allows the money not only to be collected but then to be dispersed and also takes a look at the position authority for the DMV in order to allow a person or persons to be able to accommodate that.
Thank you.
Thank you. And my apologies for not getting your name right, but thank you. All right. Larry Runk.
Madam Chair, I just would like to say, too, that it would be important that we recognize that because agriculture and forest and those things, those kinds of uses, farming, agriculture, and forestry use, are exempt, that's probably where the largest number of these rigs are stolen and resold and those kinds of things. So the probably one of the areas that you're trying to aim at is exempt from the bill. So I just editorialize again.
All right.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. I enjoy the editorializing.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Larry Runk. It's spelled R-U-N-K. From a law enforcement side, they pretty well summed up just about everything I was going to tell you. However, Class 1 and Class 3 at the present time is not required insurance, only Class 2. Class 2 is anything over 15 inches wide and over 800 pounds. The new rhinos that are out are 54 inches wide and 1,040 pounds. They are required insurance, just like the sand rails, just like the pickup trucks and jeeps and so forth, so on public lands. Class 1 and Class 3 are not required insurance. People can put them on if they so desire, just like now. People can register their quads and dirt bikes, but it's only on a voluntary basis. Once DMV stopped that practice, you can imagine that theft rate went up dramatically. And right now, at the present time, if I run a VIN number on a quad or a dirt bike, 9 times out of 10, it'll come back unable to locate. That VIN number will not capture the registered owner. You run it through LEDS, which is in Oregon, run it through NCIC, which is nationally. Unless somebody has pre-registered their vehicle and have a registration or title or a certificate of numbers that you get from the dealership when you buy one and have that information, if one of their quads or dirt bikes is stolen, then we can't get the registered owner. However, also, just for your information, the state of Washington and the state of California both register their quads and dirt bikes. They also register their ATV stickers. So I can run an ATV sticker through that prospective state's DMV and get the registered owner. And maybe in the future there may be some type of mechanism where state parks can capture the ATV sticker number and the registration off of DMV. Hopefully that would work. As far as the registration is concerned, I can't think of any officer or anybody that has one of these quads or dirt bikes that pay a lot of money for these things why they wouldn't want to register them. It's easier for the police officers to track the VIN number from the registered owner if it's registered.
Thank you.
Any questions I can help with? I did recover a stolen dirt bike last summer, but the VIN had been altered, and I never did get the registration number. I did, however, finally run that about 3 or 4 times, and I did find out it was stolen out of Roseburg. So I did capture the young man who was riding it and made sure the owner got his dirt bike back.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Say, if you find a green Honda 350 for little kids, you want to give me a call? We're still looking for it.
I know, like I said, people pay a lot of money for their machines. And if you had one stolen, I'm pretty sure you'd like to help us as best you can get a registered owner and help you get your machine back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the department's heart is in the right place on this. I really do. What I'm struggling with is as Representative Butler was sharing, that I'm not sure this is going to lower the crime rate
on the stealing of an ATV. My ATVs did everything right. They're titled, fully insured, pictures of them, everything. They're gone. They're gone. If someone wants to steal it, they're going to steal it. I didn't use due diligence. I should have had mine chained up. Stolen right out of the hotel here in Salem. They're gone. And I'm not sure having a dual registration system, more than the one we already have with state parks, is going to make any difference. And so I respect your thoughts and opinions, and I truly appreciate the work you do. I just think this is a solution that isn't going to solve the problem.
Any other questions?
I'm struggling with the Class 1 and Class 3 that Mr. Runk has identified. What is Class 1? What is Class 2? What is Class 3 on these? Are we registering and proposing now to go ahead and register ATVs and dirt bikes in Oregon? Is that what this is about?
Class 1 is four-wheel quads. Class 2 is sandrails, jeeps, pickups, the new utilities that are out, the Yamaha two-seaters, and Class 3 is dirt bikes.
So Class 2 is basically dune buggies, kind of?
Dune buggies, pickups, jeeps, the rhinos that are out. And they all require insurance under the law. Class 2 only. Class 1 and 3 are not required at this time.
Madam Chair, does this then require insurance then? Is that what we're saying? It's just the licensing of them. So it's
a
precursor for insurance, I suppose. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Buckley. To clarify then, for Class 2, can all Class 2 vehicles also operate on the street?
Negative.
None?
No, sir.
Okay.
Sand rails are specifically off-road.
Right.
You can have a pickup or a Jeep that's specifically designed for off-road.
Right.
And the rhinos are off-road.
So basically, may I follow?
Yes, you may follow.
So this bill would basically place Class 1 and Class 3 in the same category. Then it's a off-road vehicle that would require titling.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one instance where a Banshee was stolen out of the Horsefall lot about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. I found the frame of that vehicle out on the sand. They completely stripped it. And without that VIN number, I have no idea who it belonged to. And trying to get the parts back is almost impossible.
So I have a quick question before
Madam Chair.
We go on. Thank you. It has been talked about the Parks Department collecting this and keeping this information. Is that a place that people would logically go to run those kind of numbers? It doesn't seem to me, but...
No, Madam Chair. I don't think right now that the Parks is set up to have that information captured. The registration that they receive anybody can write down a registration, but it's not confirmed where... There's a mechanism at the Department of Motor Vehicles where it would be confirmed who you are and have the VIN number and everything registered and titled. What this bill would also capture is people who buy, say, a used quad from a private party that doesn't have any paperwork. That person that bought it could take it to DMV and have it registered.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you so much for coming back to testify for us. Sean Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I represent the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association, and specific to House Bill 2064, brought to my attention that we have, from the dealer's perspective, we have some issues with Section 2, Subsection 3 which is on the first page, lines 29 through 31. And specifically, what the bill requires is that dealers who sell these ATVs shall accept application and fees for title, and shall being the key word there, mandatory, obviously, given the language. And one of the problems with that is that dealers, for convenience sake, obviously when they sell an ATV, if someone comes in and spends $5,000, for an example, they're able to get the title, obviously, that day because they own the vehicle. It's their choice if they want to, and obviously the bill is geared towards the owner titling that vehicle or that ATV. And dealers for a service will do that for them if they want. And we are allowed a document fee, a doc fee, which... for instance, this fee is $55. We can charge, let's say, up to $105 to do all the paperwork, to follow up, and to title that for them if we want. Unfortunately, the Department of Justice has told dealers that we cannot require somebody to say that we as dealers must do it for them and pay the higher fee. If someone wants to go in off the street and do it themselves, they can do that. And so this seems to contradict with that language. I've talked with Jim Myron and Jack Evans. I think procedurally, if we do it just the way it is now with any other automobile that's titling, we're okay with that. But I would defer to the expertise of the Department of Motor Vehicles to, and Jack Evans to get that wording right. But I just wanted to raise that as an issue from the dealer's perspective, because this is mandatory, and I think it's something that I think would contradict to something the Department of Justice has told us we cannot do. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sean, it's my understanding that they're on line 30 with the language shall accept application and fee for the title. That if you had a customer coming in from Nevada or Montana, that at that particular point, basically you're mandatory, in a mandatory situation, that you're licensing it up for them in Oregon. And even if they are from Idaho or Washington or California, you're still forcing upon them an Oregon title where they're going to have to go back to their own state in the case of Washington, California, and Idaho, and retitle it again. So you're really doubling up that fee with this language. Is that correct?
That is, Madam Chair, Representative Butler, that is absolutely correct. That was one of the other examples that I should have raised, is that it would require that in that instance, especially border towns like Ontario, where they would actually be taking it over and entitling it in Idaho if they live there, and in Vancouver, if a customer came over to our Portland dealerships and were to buy one, this seems to think that we would have to title them. And if they put cash on the table and get the title, they should be able to go and title it to whatever state they live in and under those requirements and those laws and rules. In this particular bill, it's the owner's responsibility, is the way I read this. Obviously, the penalty are geared towards the owner entitlement. So this requirement, I just think, would need cleaned up, and I wanted to raise that flag on subsection 3 of section 2. And again, my conversations with both Jim and Jack, I think it's something that could be done.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
And I'm also assuming that there are a large number of these sold. There certainly would be in Ontario area. A large number of these are being sold for farming and agriculture and forestry work, which would not require all of this additional work, the mandatory paperwork. And so with the term that you shall accept the application fees, that precludes that from having really the exemption that's required under the act as it's presently presented before.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I think if when you make subsection 3 the optional, I think you fix all those problems.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sean, so how does ORS go with other motor vehicles? If somebody comes in to buy an automobile, does it say the dealer shall accept application and fees?
Well, currently, and the way I understand it, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, is that we will do that for them, and we can charge a doc fee, which is an extra fee. We can require them, and I need to double check on this, we can require them to run it through this, we just can't require them to pay the extra fee. And so
I'm not sure, follow up. I just want you to tell me if this were pertaining to other kinds of motor vehicles, automobiles, how would it be stated?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, it would be optional, and that's the...
So it would say may accept applications?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not sure if we have to rework that whole section to get the right wording. That's when I just found out about this afternoon. I talked to Jack Evans. I think we'd have to figure that out, and we're open to trying to figure that out. I'm not sure to answer your question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I have a quick question for you. If a person did come down to a dealer in Oregon from Washington and wanted you to title it for him in Washington, are your dealers not able to do that?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I think some of them would, if that was their requirements up there, most dealers are going to try to please their customers. And so whatever those laws are, they would normally do whatever it takes to please their customer. I don't think we're going to require something on them that they may not otherwise want to do. And so it's a good question. I'm willing to go ask some of our dealers at ADVs
on those
circumstances. And Monty might know as well. So thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Monty King and April McVeigh.
Madam Chair and committee members, I represent Oregon Power Sports Association. My name is April McVeigh. Thank you for letting us testify today. Basically, we just see some, what's been mentioned here, we see some conflicts with the way that it's written. We see that there may be problems that arise from ownership documentation and how these people turn in and get the documentation. Say if they've lost the bill of sale, how are they going to get that from a person that they might not have contact information from to then go ahead and title a used ATV? I think there's going to be a lot of burden on consumers, dealers, and DMV to try and get that documentation to title the vehicle. The other point that we have questions about is that there's a $55 fee that they're going to charge for that titling, and when vehicles get titled for $55, it's my understanding that a percentage of that actually goes to the roads, to the highways, and all of that. And so my question would be, why are we paying a fee that goes to the highways when these aren't ridden road on the highways? So that was our other question on that. We would like it to remain voluntary and just have that fee evaluated and see exactly where the money's going to go for the $55. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Monty King. I'm president of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. Our concerns kind of mirror OPSA's also. There's a couple different, the section down on line 30, we think it does say you have to title these. The other, my remembrance of the rules and statutes, because I teach this stuff all the time, says a dealer may accept title and registration. It does not have to. So every dealer is a DMV agent. When they accept the money, it's just like DMV got it. So they can put a temporary registration thing on the back window. So it does say may. So certainly that doesn't say may anymore, and I think all those problems that Representative Butler was talking about are certainly true. It's going to create some inequities that are not there now. When a Oregon dealer advertises in the same magazine as a Washington dealer, there's already an inequity. A Washington dealer can say the price is $5,000 and then have a little thing that says plus construction, basically putting the motorcycle or the ATV together. Department of Justice in Oregon says you have to put that cost of building that, putting it together, within the price. so that Washington dealer already can say something $200, $300, $400, $500 under what the Oregon dealer is, because there's a difference on who can say, you know, what's part of the price. The rules are different already, so this is going to put something else in there. The age of ATVs. It's like everybody's been talking about ATVs are always new. They're always worth $5,000. Well, they're not. They're worth $500 and $300 and $700 and all those different things of all those used ATVs, but we're talking $55 every time. That doesn't seem equitable to us. The question on Washington titling. Oregon dealers generally don't do any titling or much up there at all, because it's a very, very difficult process. You got to know what the tax rate is for the block they live on, wherever it is in Washington. There are special agents that handle these for dealers, and they cost a lot of money to deal with, because otherwise, if there's a loan, you got to send the stuff up to the DMV, and then the customer has to go over and meet the paperwork over at the DMV, and they got to pay their taxes. But if they don't show up, your deal kind of goes backwards, especially if there's a lender, because they never got in there to do the deal, and your deal falls apart, so most dealers don't even want to handle anything. So, but Washington dealers, because Oregon is so simple, they title our stuff all the time. In fact, a Washington dealer, my understanding is they can be an Oregon DMV agent, but they don't let us be their agents. So there are some differences there that are pretty great. Somebody also said that all vehicles are $55. They're not. There are some $80 ones, big trucks and stuff. My understanding a few years ago, back when the road funds went into effect, was that different vehicles needed to pay different rates based on their use of the road. And that's why big truck titles were $80 and cars were $55. I also remember back in 01, I think it was, that the cost of a title was $17 to produce for DMV. Now, if you're going to require titles, fine. Do the cost of it. But as far as putting the difference between 17 or whatever it is and 55 into the road fund, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us, because they don't go on the roads. But you say, wait a minute, it's on the trailer. It's on the truck. Whatever. So they are kind of using the road. We're talking registration, though, for the trailer. The trailer is registered by the weight of what it's carrying, which is the ATV. So in effect, that we are already paying for the use of the road by the ATV when they are going over the road. So where's the extra, how much is it? 17 minus 55, how much is that? 45, 38 bucks. Where's the other $38 going? Is it going for ATV stuff, or is it going for roads and bridges? No. I think you ought to get all the money you can for roads and bridges, but I think you ought to do it in an equitable manner, as Representative Smith said, not a tax on ATV people. If you're going to title, let's make the title what it costs them. Because there isn't any, unless you're going to move that money over to things that are for ATV people. So that's our position.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. King, I'm stuck in Class 2 world. Would you make the same argument for Class 2s, that since they don't use the roads, that they're off-road vehicles also, their titling fee should be just the amount of the cost of performing titling function, anything extra should be distributed differently?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I don't know. Nobody's come to us and talked about Class 2s whatsoever in this process. I remember having a beach buggy back in the old days, too, and I paid the same rate. I didn't think about it. But now we're talking about a lot more people and a lot of money. Some of those units are very expensive. But, yeah, as they get older and older and older, quite frankly, most people don't ever title them anyway. When they sell them and they're old, they don't title them. They don't jump down to DMV and pay the $55. They just sign the back of the title, and away they go. In fact, DMV, my understanding is, they will accept a bill of sale on a vehicle not subject to odometer limits. It doesn't matter how many you've had. You can have 15 bills of sales attached to a title, and they will accept it, even if they are all on toilet paper, as long as you can reproduce it. You can copy it. A bill of sale is valid. It doesn't have to be on a DMV form or anything. So are people doing a titling? No. They're not doing the cart and other stuff already, so...
Some vehicles I bought should have had their title on toilet paper. I think that would have been inappropriate for them. I guess the point I was just making comment that there does seem to be an issue of fairness here. If Class 2 is titled in a certain way, shouldn't Class 1 and 3 be titled a similar way? I mean, it's going to open up a different door for me, but
right.
There it goes.
Thank you. Any other question?
I have a question, probably not for Monty and Ms. McVeigh, but... The question is relative to the, I think the Constitution provides that monies that go into that highway fund must be appropriate based upon the actual cost. You can't lose money
right.
at DMV in that process. But it also provides that excess monies, because remember we have that lawnmower fund that the people that are putting gas in these off-road vehicles are supposed to be in effect reclaiming it as a credit against the vehicle, and we're supposed to be returning it. To the extent that we don't, it can't go into the highway use fund because it's constitutionally protected that only that money goes in there. So that's some excellent questions are coming out of this about the collection on this thing. If we are collecting too much, we're probably in violation of the Constitution. If we collect too much as a result of this, and it goes to subsidize other activities, we've been down that road before, and it's something that we can't do. So maybe we're going to have DMV come forward and let us know.
Yeah, I thought maybe we at least have some questions. But Monty, I have one comment for you. When you talk about the inequities between Washington and Oregon, what you didn't say was that Washington has a sales tax, which does change that inequity somewhat. So next time you give that little spiel, you could add that piece, right?
but Madam Chairman, when a Oregonian goes to Washington buy an ATV to bring back here, they don't pay the sales tax.
That's correct.
When they come down here to buy the vehicle and they take it back, they go to DMV and they pay their sales tax. But they're not paying, what are they not paying? Are they not paying income tax or property tax? They're not paying one of them other taxes. Okay, so yeah, there's some back and forth on that, but you know, we can't go up there and title very easy. It's real dangerous.
Thank you for answering that question. Thank you. And would Mr. Jack Evans like to come up and at least get a list of questions if he can't answer them all?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Evans with ODOT, and here to answer questions to the best that I can. Let me just say ODOT is, of course, neutral on this. We have no problems with this bill. We are currently titling, as was brought out in the testimony, these vehicles on an optional basis, and we do about 1,200 a year optionally. The last time we titled vehicles in the mandatory, prior to 2000, there were about 8,900 that we titled. We project that, given the sales of these ATVs, we would anticipate the remainder of the biennium having a need to title about 37,000, and then for the second biennium about 53,000. So that's based on primarily new transactions, and the $55, I can't speak to with a great deal of depth about that, but yes, all of our projections of revenue is based upon these transaction projections, these estimates of what we might see multiplied by that $55. The $55 is what we're charging now for all vehicles, with the exception of the heavy trucks over 26,000 pounds, which are $90. Everything else is $55, including these optional titling of these ATVs.
Thank you.
So with that, I'll...
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you maybe answer the question that I'd asked before? On lines 29 to 30, it says dealers shall accept application and fees for Class 1 or Class 3. So my question to another speaker was, now motor vehicles, including automobiles, does that apply to them? The dealer shall accept application and fees?
Madam Chair, Representative Tomei, no. At this point in time, vehicle dealers, as our agents, have the capacity to do that, but it is
permissive.
Their option.
It's permissive.
It is permissive. So you could say may. I mean, we could study this and work with parks to make this more acceptable. But one option is just to strike number three altogether, because it's pretty much covered in the fact that the dealers are our agents and they can do this. They can offer this service, but it's not mandatory.
Great. Thank you. That helps me very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dave Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If my numbers are correct, doing 37,000 and 53,000 in years one and two, the total resource or the total income, and it's indicated that you'd have to have another staff position, but right now you're looking at nearly $5 million in the first biennium in collections. Does the excess of this go into the road fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, the figures that I have are based upon those numbers of transactions would put it at around $2 million for the remaining 18 months of the first biennium, and then $2.9 million for the second biennium.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think you were giving – I misunderstood. When you said first year and second year, I thought it was – it's really biennium.
It's biennium. I'm sorry if I misspoke. And, yes, that would – what we're looking at are those transition numbers generating the equivalent of one FTE, the amount of transaction time and the amount of activity would amount to about one FTE. The remainder of those funds, of that $55, goes right into the highway fund.
And the follow-up then, Madam
yes,
Chair.
Yes, please.
Jack, shouldn't the fuel be run through this into the lawnmower account that you have presently? This is off-road vehicle fuel.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I simply don't know enough about that transportation operating fund to answer your question. I can certainly find out.
Madam Chair, I'd like also Jack, while he's finding that out, to find out what's happening with this excess, because it's my understanding is it can't go into the road fund. It's got to be segregated out of there because they're non-highway vehicles. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just a comment. I think education would love that money.
It's in the form of motion.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2064. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2456.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2456 prohibits the State Board of Education from allowing the use of school buses manufactured before April 1, 1977. It does provide that the operation of a prohibited school bus is a Class B traffic violation, punishable with a fine of up to $360. It would declare an emergency effective August 1, 2007. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay. The first name we have up here is Mary Ann Guest.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mary Ann Gelston. I represent the Oregon School Employees Association. So if you see my face and remember me as something else, today I'm representing Oregon School Employees Association, which represents around 20,000 educational professionals in our school districts, and many of those are bus drivers. House Bill, we are supporting House Bill 2456. It would prohibit school districts from operating school buses manufactured prior to 1977. There are currently, in our research, there's 12 of these buses on the roads. Two of the 12 are used by private schools, Blanchett and Salem Academy. Nine are operated by the private sector for private bus companies who have contracted with the school districts. Those nine are currently operated in Wallowa. They have five of them, and Enterprise has four. Fenlopine School District is the only district operating its own student transportation services that still has one bus that is pre-1977 in its fleet. We did hear that they recently have purchased five new buses. But we did also hear that they plan to keep the old bus as a backup, so I'm not sure it'll be retired or not. After a series of school bus accidents claiming the lives of many children, the federal government implemented construction standards for school buses designed to dramatically improve safety standards. School buses manufactured after April 1, 1977 must comply with these construction standards. And the new standards include padded high-back seats, energy-absorbing seats, as well as special requirements for wheelchair restraint systems, brake systems that enable the school bus to stop in a shorter distance than other large vehicles, protective fuel tanks, lamps, and reflective devices that indicate when the bus is loading and unloading passengers, special mirrors that allow the driver to see critical areas directly in front of the bus and on the sides, and a stop arm that extends out to the left side of the bus to warn motorists when the bus is loading or unloading passengers. The federal government regulates the standards of how these buses are built, but you, the state, determine what buses are being driven on the road. In 2001, according to the Oregon Department of Education, there were 166 pre-1977 school buses transporting kids. Now, as you can see, we're down to 12, so school districts are making that transition slowly. The federal, the Oregon Constitution requires mandatory education in Oregon, and thus many of our students are transported to school. Parents assume that the buses are safe, and the school districts would not operate unsafe buses. With the implementation of the new construction safety standards, school buses are now the safest form of transportation in the United States and are also the most efficient way to transport students. As technology evolves and experience teaches us, newer school buses are more fuel efficient and meet federal standards for emissions. They also meet the newest safety standards adopted by the federal government in 1993 after a series of tragic school bus fires. They include more exits for children and also fire retardant seats. The cost of these new school buses is about $80,000. Now that seems like a lot, but when you compare it to a larger vehicle, it doesn't seem like such a high number. As part of the school district's transportation reimbursement, the state school fund provides a school bus depreciation reimbursement on new buses equaling 10% of the bus value per year for the first 10 years of ownership. So the school district actually gets this money, it's put into an account, and then at the end of 10 years can buy a new bus. So they should start turning over quicker. This funding allocation is meant to provide a major assist to school districts to encourage them to turn over their buses in a timely way to reduce costs and liability associated with outdated, worn-out school buses. OSA is working with the governor's office and others this session to find additional funding sources for school districts to be used to update their school bus fleet. House Bill 2172, which I'm sure you'll hear all about, the Clean Diesel Act, will provide funding incentives to school districts and other owners of large diesel engines to retrofit or replace old diesel engines to meet clean air standards. This is a particularly important because children are around these buses quite a bit, and they consume more air than an adult does. It will have the added benefit of assuring that more children would be transported in school buses meeting the latest safety standards, thus assuring that our children are as safe as possible on the road. So we heartily endorse House Bill 2456 and hope you will pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, thank you very much. If we mandate, I have a concern about going out and mandating Blanchett and other parochial schools what they must obey based upon OSEA's perception of a problem. That said, my concern is then how the state of Oregon goes around and tell folks what's safe and not safe based upon, you know, a law that's 30 years after the manufacture date of these things. If we're not going to push these buses into other private districts and other places, maybe even outside of Oregon, to be used on children who may not be of the socioeconomic cut and bent that you folks would like to serve. And I'm concerned about telling folks here, these buses aren't good enough for us, but they are good enough for somebody of your stature.
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, I'm not sure what the question was, but as I understand it, the school buses means all school buses, private schools, private owned. It means all school buses in the state of Oregon. And also the federal standards aren't set by OSEA. They're set by the federal government, and then we comply.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just very anxious about this, us going and telling Blanchett and other parochial schools that their buses aren't safe for their children, that they've got to dispose of those buses. Where are they going to go? I'm going to guess that these buses will go into, because they're very functional buses. Recognize, please, that some of these buses were operating in some of my districts up until just the last couple of years, and as we had the resources to spend these things out, then we've done that. But they haven't been junked. They've gone to cheaper, poorer school districts and other places, perhaps up in Wallowa or out in Enterprise or those places where they can get along with those pieces of equipment. So I'm anxious I'm not saying these folks are setting the standards. It's my concern that certainly they ought to be safe, but for us to go tell a parochial school what you're doing is safe or not safe based upon what we're not paying any of their freight. They're not going to get 10 cents from the school fund. It doesn't cost OSEA or any other public employee union a dime to go tell the Catholic schools what they ought to be doing with regard to how they transport their youngsters. But I'm not going to be part of that. I can assure you of that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Smith? I'll defer to Representative Butler.
Just to comment back, I mean, I don't see a difference between unsafe practices in any school in Oregon. We don't allow schools to serve food that is poisoned, and we don't allow them to set up gymnastic equipment that is dangerous to children. We do have safety laws in the state. And I guess my question would be, in our surrounding states, would there be a danger that these buses would be, you know, shuffled off to Washington or Idaho for use in districts there? Do you know if there are laws banning the use of these buses in those states?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, I believe that Deborah Lincoln from the Department of Education Transportation District could answer that question. I don't know.
Thank you.
But it's a good question.
Thank you, Chair Byer.
Do we know that of those 12 buses that they can't be retrofitted to be safe?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't think so. I think it's the construction standards of the chassis, and so you're talking a whole new rebuilt from top to bottom bus.
The concern I have with House Bill 2456, Madam Chair, is that 9 of the 12 buses that you're referring to reside right in the heart of my district.
Oh.
And it's also in a very economically depressed part of the state of Oregon, and our schools are struggling as is. Mm-hmm. And how do they pay for this? If 9 of those 12 buses are instantly taken offline, how do they pay for that?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know in the near future how they would do that, but I know if they owned them in-house that they would get the bus depreciation dollars and be able to then, from the state, and be able to turn them over and get their money back. So I'm not sure, since they're contracted out, I'm not sure how it would work. But I believe the bigger issue here isn't really whether the districts have the money. I mean, we are searching for money to look at buying new buses across the board. But I think the bigger issue is safety. I mean, these buses, if you have a tragedy, if you have an accident, these kids could be gone. And so it's a question of liability and other things that are really important that need to be as high as a concern as the money. And I agree money is an issue, but we are looking for funds.
Just a quick follow-up, if I may. I know our local school boards do everything they can to assure the safety of their children, and I just can't believe that they would purposely or knowingly place their children into unsafe buses. And so while I appreciate the intent of House Bill 2456, I'm struggling with it because, again, 9 of those 12 are in my district, and I'm not willing to accept that they knowingly or purposely are putting their children in danger. And I'll go back and talk to them and find out what is the status behind these 9 out of 12 buses. And I share the opinions of Representative Butler as well on dictating to a private entity the parameters under which we operate. The question I do have, though, is where did this legislation come from? Was it as a result of the 9 out of 12 school buses in my district?
Can I go ahead? I'm sitting on Transportation Committee. Last session, we had a discussion, and I could let Representative Gilman go over this since he was chair on safety belts in school buses. And during the presentation, which we have someone here on, it came out that these buses were still on the road, and they really are very unsafe buses. And if I remember right, we had a video presentation at that point, and it might be something that might be worthwhile to have again to see. See, we have a DVD right here that we can share, but. And that's where it came from. It didn't move last session, Representative Hunt was on the committee at the time, too. And so this is one that we felt, I agree with him, is a very important safety issue. And so I don't know if that answers your question, but Representative Gilman wanted to talk, and I probably just...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we discussed this a bit, and... I'm just sure that every one of those school districts, and then 2 years ago, I had a school district with some of those buses. They're gone now. And I don't think any one of those boards is purposely putting those kids in at risk.
Mark Thielman from the law. Who's going to call?
You see, in 2001, there were 166 buses that were unsafe out on the road, and now it's down to 12. Mm-hmm. That's 154 buses, I believe, in 6 years that have gone by the wayside. That's an average of 25 a year. Looks to me, if we just leave this alone, by next biennium, there won't be any problem.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No other questions? Okay.
But I do. If I may.
You may.
Thank you. Ms. Guest, have you talked with people at these school districts about this issue?
Not personally, no, I haven't. Sorry about that, Madam Chair, Representative Tomei. I have not. But I do understand that Deborah Lincoln has talked to them, and
great.
She may have more information.
Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you so
Thanks.
Much. Deborah Lincoln, please.
I know all this legislation.
But you're getting all the money, too.
Go ahead. Of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Lincoln. I'm the Director of Pupil Transportation and Fingerprinting for the Oregon Department of Education. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2456. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, regulates the construction standard of school buses. Manufacturers must comply and certify that their vehicles meet construction standards through a series of Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards called FMVSs that NHTSA establishes for trucks, cars, passenger cars, or equipment that's added to these vehicles. NHTSA has issued 36 Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards which apply to school buses. These cover things like the braking system, steering, glazing, lights, fuel integrity system, defrosters, heater, compressed gas. And, for example, there are four that are specific to school buses. And I've provided for you a diagram of all of the Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards that apply to school buses. And I would like to point out a few really key Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards. I'm going to call them FMVSs. Number 111 applies to the mirrors so that the seated driver can see from their the front and along the sides, of course, if any children were in the area. 217 covers the emergency egress. It tells how many emergency exits or roof hatches that a bus has to have per seating space. FMVS 302 is the flammability of interior materials so that it specifies the burn rate. And then the four that are unique to only school buses is the school bus pedestrian safety devices, 131, which has that stop arm on the side of buses, 220, which is, and these are the really critical ones that make a difference here today, 220, which is school bus rollover protection. This specifies the minimum structural strength that a school bus has to have in a rollover type crash. 221 is school bus body joint strength, which specifies the minimum strength of the joint between the panels that comprise the school bus body. 222 is the school bus passenger and seating crash protection. That's essentially why we don't have seat belts, is because of the protection that it provides in that compartment and the way the seats are attached to the floor and the way the padding is on the back of the seats and the way they give in an impact. So what we have created is a very safe compartment. According to NHTSA, school buses are the safest form of transportation, and it's in part because of these particular safety standards. School buses manufactured prior to April 1, 1977 do not meet FMVS 111, 217, 220, 221, 222, and 302. Oregon is one of the only a few states that still allow pre-77 buses, and I tried to get that actual number before I came today, and I wasn't able to. But I see the surveys every year, and we're just a handful of states that even allow pre-77 buses anymore. And as you've heard, we have 12 left in the state. The department's been very proactive telling districts you need to get rid of these buses because they just don't meet the joint strength, and in case of an accident, they're going to come apart. So there's one in Bend, one at Salem Academy, one at Blanchett, four at Enterprise, and five at Wallowa. I've spoke to everybody at each one of these districts. Bend has already, that's been a spare, and they planned on getting rid of it. Anyway, Salem Academy was happy to get rid of theirs, and Blanchett has already purchased a new bus, and they're ready to replace this one also. As regards to Enterprise and Wallowa school districts, and I've also spoke to Moffitt Brother Transportation, which is their contractor, I've discussed with them at length the options that they have and that exist, what they could do to become in compliance with this law. For example, they could purchase older buses, 1993 or older, and the reason we picked newer, 1993 is because that was when the 217 came into effect that had the emergency egress and the flammability. And so currently, by administrative rule, a district could
move a bus in Oregon that's 1993 or newer anytime they want to. So if Moffett Brothers wanted to stay in business and wanted to purchase a bus that was 93 or newer, they could relocate it without any problems or any additional regulations into the used by Wallowa and Enterprise School District.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Just really quick, because I think it's timely here. So I do appreciate this information. This really answers a lot of questions for me. For the school districts that are contracting with private industry, really what this legislation is going to do is tell private industry they need to upgrade their standards. And so the burden necessarily isn't on the school district and financially. It's on the private industry to make sure that they're meeting industry standards.
Chair Byrne,
is that an assumption state?
That is correct.
So can I follow up on that just really quick? So, it's nice sometimes to be wrong, and so I appreciate the information that's provided. Really what we're doing is we're telling an industry, a company, you need to increase your standards and not be providing lower quality buses to the folks in Enterprise and Wallowa.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair assessment?
Chair Byer, Representative Smith, I believe that's what you're going to say. And there was a comment earlier that this is probably going to go away in the next biennium. No, I don't think it's going to.
Until you force the company.
That's correct. They have chosen to continue to use those buses, and I'm not sure they fully understand the importance of upgrading their fleet to something newer.
Thank you. That's been really helpful for me.
Yes. I just want to continue on with some other options that we've given those districts, that they could also purchase newer buses from other states. And even if they didn't meet current administrative rules, we told them that they could, we would grant them variances from the current standards on anything that they couldn't change to meet those standards. We would expect them, for example, to change the lettering. That's a very simple fix. But if there was something that they couldn't meet the standards, we would grant them variances as long as they improved the age of the fleet. Purchasing new school buses probably is not an option because it takes about a year to order a school bus and get it purchased and made and brought to you, delivered. The Department of Education has been very proactive in helping school districts upgrade and keep the age of their fleet new. A portion of the state school fund reimburses for new equipment. The districts receive 10% per year for 10 years. And there's a statutory requirement that says that the district has to put that money into a special fund so that they can only purchase new school buses with that. And as you've heard, the department has been really encouraging districts to get rid of the pre-77 buses, and most districts have complied with that and gotten rid of the pre-77 school buses. I just want to say one thing in closing, that school bus transportation in Oregon has an excellent safety record. In part, it's because of the equipment and the improvement that continues to be made in equipment. But it's also because of the well-trained and caring drivers that operate them. And it's for these reasons that I would urge you to support House Bill 2456. And I really thank you for your time and consideration. I would be happy to answer any questions you have or had that the other people weren't able to answer.
Thank you. Representative
Tony? I just want to clarify that the state school fund would eventually reimburse every school district for their bus. Is that correct? It's 10% a year for 10 years. Correct?
Chair Byer, Representative Tomei, if the district owns the bus, that answer is correct. It would be reimbursed after 10 years. They should have enough, in theory, to purchase a new school bus. When a district chooses to contract, they don't own the buses. Usually the contractor owns the buses. And as part of doing business to increase, update your fleet, just like purchasing gas and new tires, so it would be up to the contractor to purchase the equipment. They don't actually get reimbursed. How they would get paid is they give the bill to the district pays them, and they submit those expenses to the department, and we reimburse them 70%.
I just follow up. So they reimburse 70%, but they would not eventually pay for the school bus. If they didn't, if the school district did not purchase it themselves, if the whoever operates, what am I trying to say, who owns the company that's operating the bus, they would not be reimbursed as the school would be.
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, let me go back and just explain a little bit. There's really two basic parts of the school fund. One, districts get 70%. Now, there are some districts that get 80 and some that get 9, but for the purposes, we're just going to say 70%. Districts get 70% of their transportation costs reimbursed. Then, in addition to that, when they own the school buses, they get 10% per year over 10 years. And they also get 4% over 25 years of the garage in depreciation. So that is how that school fund formula works. And they put it all together, and then they get 70% of the cost.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And colleagues, I really appreciate this this information. It's changed my opinion on this legislation, and I appreciate you providing that. Why wouldn't a school district, why would they contract? If they're reimbursed 70% and they have a depreciation assistance program, why would they contract that out?
Chair Beyer, Representative Smith, transportation is extremely complicated. And for a district that's very small, it's very difficult to be aware of all the changes, rules about construction standards. There's been a lot of changes and about driver changes, the CDL, S endorsements, drug testing, and sometimes they don't want to be involved with the day-to-day dealing with parents in the transportation and making the decision whether we're going to run and just equipment needs. And we found the smaller the district, it is better to contract. And also, a lot of times they contract because of rising cost of PERS, health insurance, and that they feel that they can operate cheaper by just contracting and let a contractor totally take care of all that. Another thing I wanted to point out too is that some contracts actually have an age limit of the fleet, and they'll say that you can't have a vehicle that's more than 8 years old. That's a very common clause. Moffett Brothers apparently doesn't have that clause with
Enterprise or just really quick, Madam Chair. My opinion earlier was based upon not. I get frustrated with this building when we dictate to local school districts. I believe in local control, strongly believe in it. But under the information you've provided to us, it seems like it's we have every right as a state agency to set this is the standard that we're going to set, and you private industry who want to do business with the state of Oregon, because it's their option to do business. If you don't want to do business, don't do business with us. To either meet that standard or not. And so I just want to explain myself for why I've changed my thoughts.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions here?
Thank you. May I make a follow-up to that?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say for the record, too, that the state does require transportation, and when they enacted those laws to require transportation is when they also said, okay, we're going to require it, but we're going to pay for it. And that's where that 70% came from. I would also like to say on the record that Moffett Brothers Transportation is a very reputable company.
They do a good job.
And I've seen their buses personally. I happen to know the family personally. The equipment is meticulously clean, and they do run a good operation. They just are not using a current fleet, and our concern is that should they have an accident in one of those vehicles, the structural strength is not going to be there, and it is going to come apart.
Thank you. Well, the next person we have is going to be on the phone, and that's I'll let Judith try to connect here. And it's Mark Bellman from the Wallawa School District.
Just
call collect pigeon.
Loud schools.
Is this Mr. Thelman?
Yes.
Yes, this is Representative Beyer, Chair of the House Transportation Committee.
Nice to meet you.
Good to hear from you, and we're looking forward to some testimony from you. So you're welcome to go ahead and start.
Well, you know, I hate to be the unvolunteered bearer of bad news. The bill came to my attention from Deborah Lincoln from DOE.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I guess as they were looking at the potential impact, it turns out, and I'm new superintendent, I've been here about 6 months.
Oh, wow.
imagine my shock, all our buses are too old, huh? So we're looking at, we have about an 8-bus fleet, and 6 of them are older than 77. And for me, as I've investigated, you know, I talked a little bit with Deborah and then Representative Hunt's assistant a little bit. I think we do want to have newer buses for our kids to travel on. My only concern is I don't want to bankrupt the district, of course, because it's very, very difficult to do that by August 1st in terms of replacing our entire fleet. So anyway, that's what got this ball rolling, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. For me, I was talked a little bit about if we could work out some kind of pathway for compliance for small districts like us. There's really only two that I know of in the state. One is Wallowa, that's us, and then our neighboring district, which is Enterprise. And so really it's kind of a Wallowa County issue. And I wanted to make sure everybody was aware of that. And then to go on record saying that, you know, we don't want to fight the intention of this bill, I think, is very good. And, of course, when you look into the safety issues, buses have dramatically improved, just as cars have done, of course, since 1977. So, again, my concern was having a modus that would allow me to comply in a way that creates a win for us and also supports the intention of the bill. And that's basically it. Is there any questions or anything else you need from me?
Yeah, there looks like there's at least one.
All right.
So, Representative Tomei.
Mr. Billman, I understand that you contract with a bus company. Is that correct?
Yes, we do. Moffitt.
And so have you talked with them about how soon they could replace the buses?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're having some conversation today kind of in anticipation of this hearing. And, you know, they're warming up to the idea. The reissue is, can we get used buses? Because we're kind of in a crunch on that. New ones, you know, there's an ordering period and you got to buy them and have to have them to you, you know, all those issues. So we really would be in a situation of trying to pick up used buses.
Right.
But you don't know what kind of condition those can be in. And, you know, depending on how they're used and where we get them from. And there's quite a shortage in.
Uh-oh.
Hi. Hello.
That's weird. There's a little. Deborah Lincoln was a little concerned because there's, you know, usually when they're retired, they're fairly worn out. So we have been shopping, and there is a potential that we can get, you know, two or three would probably be a fairly comparable number, to be fair. So, you know, for me, I was thinking, okay, you know, if we started there and then move forward, that might be helpful. Part of the thing that's kind of interesting is, you know, my question was, well, how come we haven't bought new buses until now? And some of that had to do with the relationship that we've had with our provider, because us as school districts, we haven't been buying buses. And I'm from Washington originally, and I know in Washington there's reimbursement money. And Deborah Lincoln told me, I guess in Oregon it's 10%. Are you guys aware of that?
10% a year for 10 years.
Yeah. So there is one possibility. For me, I don't want to necessarily replace our old buses with old buses. On the flip side, I want to make sure we don't bankrupt our provider. You know, if you're in a big city, it'd be nice you just go to another provider. But we're pretty remote, and the nearest one is over the mountains in LeGrand. And I'm not sure that they could provide, short of investing in a place here, like setting up another bus garage, that I don't think they could really provide a viable option for us, because I did look into that, too. So, you know, geographically, we're a little stuck that way. So I was hoping for, you know, to let you guys know what our needs are and to see if you would have any room for, you know, putting some flexibility into the bill in terms of compliance, maybe submit a plan and, you know, or something that allows us to work with the DOE a little bit. Deborah said that she would be okay to consider variances, and I told her I would share that with you guys here at the hearing. And I said I'm okay with variances as long as the law allows us to. Does that make sense? To grant variances? Is that fair to say?
Good question. We do have Deborah here.
Wonderful.
So maybe she can comment.
Okay.
Chair, Beyer, representative, I guess, no, it's superintendent. The administrative rule allows the department to grant variances to school districts when they cannot meet the administrative rule. And so that would be a simple letter from the superintendent to the state superintendent requesting a variance, telling us why they can't meet the current standards. This will actually be a law, and we won't not be able to allow pre-77 because we couldn't violate the law, but we could grant a variance to the administrative rule. So I'm thinking of something that ABS brakes, for example. Our standards in Oregon require ABS brakes, but if they found a bus that didn't have that, we could grant a variance for something like that.
Can I follow up?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Bellman, I have another question for you. This is Representative Tomei again.
Okay.
So I'm assuming that you have a contract with the bus provider.
Yes,
and
we
so
do.
Does your contract doesn't say anything about the safety of the buses or the years of the buses?
Well, no. That's, granted, being a new super, I asked that same question. You know, and where I'm at, and Deborah can vouch for me, my conversation today with the folks up at Moffitt's, which is our provider, you know, told them that we really needed to come to the table and upgrade the whole agreement, including some kind of arrangement for buying buses. This particular arrangement has worked very well, obviously, for a lot of years, but it hasn't necessitated those things that require us to continue to upgrade for safety reasons, among others. So it's a little unusual. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's fair to say.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Bellman.
Representative Gilman had a question.
Thank you. The bill, as it's written, has August 1st, 2007 as the effective date.
Mm-hmm.
If we make that 2008, do you think you could meet it?
Well, I think that would give us a lot more leeway. And again, if we could do a combo of, newer but used buses that are newer, and then that would also allow us, if the means present themselves, to order and receive maybe a new bus or two. I think the combo of that would put us in compliance. It's a lot more reasonable. But again, it would basically necessitate or give me an extra year so I wouldn't have to write a letter for variance. But I don't know if Deborah would see. I think she might be a better one to hear in terms of the necessity of do we do this by 07 or 08. But 08 would be very beneficial for me, yes.
And I want you to understand that you won't be writing a letter of variance on 08. That will be the law, and something will have to happen by that time.
Sure. Now you scared me into writing a letter of variance. Well, I think that's more reasonable. My children ride the bus, and when I, again, got better information, I had to look in the mirror and ask myself, do I want my kids on a bus that doesn't have all the safety? And no, I don't. That might be politically incorrect to say, but I think it's a reasonable thing. And if I feel that way, I think if our local parent pool got that information, I think they'd be concerned too. So again, I've been kind of a little off the cuff coming out saying, I think the bill has its purpose and we do need to upgrade. It's just, again, can we do it in a way that is a win for us and a win for the state and a win for the purpose of the legislation? I think it can be done. So, yeah, I think 08 would be a challenge, but I think we could do it.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much. I'm a father of three, too, and I think what I'm struggling with is thinking about I don't think I could live with myself if something happened to one of your kids between now and 2008 if we didn't exhaust every mean possible. to rectify this before 2008, and I'm wondering if there's any mechanism of loans, of anything we could do to come up with a proposal, which I guarantee you this legislature would be willing to consider to try to remedy this in the quickest fashion possible.
Well, I appreciate that. Hey, I'm open to any creative solution, and I'm going to meet with my board tonight and talk just a little bit about that. You know, and I don't know, again, probably would need to work with Deborah on that as well. But, yeah, it's possible. I'd be open to it anyway.
This is Chair Beyer. I have a question for you. Is it your understanding that, well, maybe I shouldn't put it that way, do you think that we have to pass this bill to get your transportation company to start upgrading their fleet, or are they going to be working on that now anyway?
Well, I was encouraged today by my conversation because, you know, they were already looking into options. When I talked to them about an agreement in which maybe the districts buy the buses, because, you know, eventually we'll get our money back, and granted, we, you know, it costs some money in the front end. But down the road, it might, and I told them this, I said, potentially we could create, you know, buy a new bus every 10 years, worst case scenario, of course, give or take. And they sure warmed up to that. That's something that I don't think they'd ever really thought was possible. Or so yeah, I mean, I think they're there. I think they see the need for it. I can't say for sure that a legislation isn't needed. You know, I mean, I can't say for sure because I don't know. I've only been here 6 months. I don't know everybody all that well. But there's, I mean, that's just the truth as I see it. So I hope that answered your question.
I think so. I that would concern me that if we gave them an extra year, that they would take an extra year before they started upgrading their fleet.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, listening to you, and maybe I'm just not listening well, if you're, because it's our understanding that if you own the fleet, you will be reimbursed for the cost of the buses over 10 years, but as long as you're contracting with this company, they won't be getting buses paid for through the state. Is that your understanding?
You know, I wasn't sure on that. Of course, my vision is that might make sense, considering that we don't have, we're not of a critical mass as a school district. We're pretty tiny.
Right.
So for us to have our own transportation department and our own transportation director and our own maintenance of the buses, on top of buying the buses, we get really good service from this particular provider. Their maintenance record is top-notch. I think Deborah could vouch for that, which is why these buses are still operating. I mean, they're extremely, you know, aged in that as far as buses go. I'm thinking in terms of bang for the buck, a relationship that allows. I mean, it's about changing the relationship. The current relationship, they have to go out of their profits to buy a new bus. So they don't buy them. Is that fair to say?
What
I'm saying is if we could have some kind of interagency agreement where there's an overarching need because of our remoteness and because of our small size to maybe allow us to buy the buses and pay them to service them. Is that reasonable or am I way out of line because I'm new to Oregon?
Well, I will ask our bus person here if she has a comment on that.
Okay.
Deborah?
Chair Beyer, yes, the district could purchase their buses and have a contractor operate them. Some districts throughout Oregon, in fact, do that. There are also a couple other options that we talked about that I didn't mention to the committee, is that there's also lease options that the bus manufacturers are willing to do a lease purchase. And there's also the clean diesel grant fund that's out there, and that's to purchase newer buses.
Did you catch all that?
I heard the lease option part, and I heard yes, that we can do creative things. So I think all those things need to come on the table.
The second one was that there were,
Chair Beyer, there's a clean diesel grant.
A clean diesel grant.
That is federally funded, and I believe there's a bill also this session that helps in Oregon with some clean diesel. I believe that's what Ms.
Right.
Guest said.
There are two options there for clean diesel.
Okay. Well, that sounds good.
And that's free money.
and free.
Free is good.
Free. So are there any other questions? Any?
Just best of luck with your new job.
Yes.
Well, thank you, you guys, and I appreciate your opportunity to testify and appreciate the good work you do.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Bye.
Bye. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you for all your help. And
Chair, right. While we still have Ms. Lincoln here, could I ask her a couple of questions?
May.
So it sounds like there are several different options. So have those options been offered to all the people who have these old buses?
Chair Beyer, Representative Tomei, I don't think that any other district needed that. First off, Salem Academy and Blanchett are private schools, and so they don't get money from the Department of Education. I think they probably still would qualify, though, for the Clean Bus Grant. And Bend is already involved in the bus depreciation, so they have been buying new buses, and they already were planning on getting rid of that bus also.
Okay. How about Enterprise?
Enterprise, we had the same discussion as I did with the superintendent from Wallawa, so that they know all the options. I also spoke with Roberta Moffitt, who operates Moffitt Brothers Transportation.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other comments, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2456, and I'm going to adjourn the meeting for today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And